Everybody, welcome to this episode of the show. Today, I'm joined by BAFTA-nominated producer Farah Abushwesha. Farah, welcome. Thanks for joining me. How are you doing?
Hi. Good, thank you.
You're being serenaded down there, from what I can tell, with the music in the background.
Yeah, there is absolutely no peace in my life whatsoever. My neighbors are literally gutting out their home, and other ones are putting in new toilets. So from about 8 o'clock in the morning, Monday to Sunday, there's like literally work. So I came down to the canal, and there is now some music going on across the way across the canal. I'm going to show you.
Do it. It's nice, though. It's good that it's back to vibrancy.
Yeah. So I've come down to a coffee shop that you'd be really quiet, but no.
I love it. Life of a producer, where there's always just hecticness going on at all times.
True. Organized chaos.
Exactly. This has been a busy week for you. We touched on it very briefly before hitting record here, but you obviously, through your company, Rocliffe, do a lot of work championing writers and directors, and you had your showcase in conjunction with BAFTA this past Tuesday, which ordinarily would have been done in person, but obviously you had to maybe shift a bit this year to bring it online. What was that process like of shifting it to the digital kind of platform, and how have you kind of found it now that it's happened? What's the feedback been like? How do you feel about it?
Well, you know, like with any production, and it was a production, it's all of a bit of an unknown. And, you know, we've been carrying out the sort of theatrical performances of BAFTA Rocliffe at 195 Piccadilly. Earlier this year, or last year, it went under reconstruction. They're doing it at Core and Shelling. Seems to be the story of my life, Core and Shelling. I know that term because I've got family in the construction trade. So they're doing a Core and Shell of 195. So we were looking at doing it in different places, but of course we come under the theatrical remit, even though it's cinema, it's live performances. So about 3 weeks ago, we had a conversation with Faye Timby, our casting director, with Sophie Holland, about the kind of the online showcases they've seen coming out of drama schools. And we thought, why not? Let's go for it. Let's, you know, just literally wing it and see, and where can we get to? And we thought also, with everybody being in lockdown and this kind of extended gap year that we all seem to be on, that first of all, we can, you know, perhaps reach more people, and, you know, also attract some, you know, big name actors that would, you know, if they can do it, they come along. But you know, we felt that we would be able to access them because they're all sitting at home, or most of them are sitting at home. And then, you know, first it was kind of like, what, can we do this? Is that possible? And we were all kind of a little bit, well, you know, let's just try it and see. And so I was calling Aradal, who normally provide the music at Rocliffe, to say that, look, we can't do any music because it's going to be on Zoom, and that's pretty limited. To which they said, oh, yes, we can. And we know a proper Zoom audio and visual technician who does has done some BBC Zoom broadcasts, as well as for various composers. And, oh, okay, we can bring music to this. Why not? And then for music, we brought in sound effects. And it just grew. And then we went out to some of the actors, and we pretty much got our first offers on all the cast. Yeah, Jack O'Connell said yes. And I think everybody nearly fell over when Jack O'Connell said yes. But, you know, it's very much like any kind of film that you do. You know, when we went out to Christopher Walken for Irreplaceable You, my Netflix original film, no one expected him to say yes. But at that point, we thought, well, how many million, you know, actors of that caliber are out there? And you know, sometimes you just got to ask. That's like following your producer's nose. You just got to ask. And the worst thing people could say is no. And you kind of, you plan for a no. And when you get a yes, it's just, everything changes.
It's true. It is that fear of like, oh, what will people think? Or that judgment of, who am I to even ask this particular person? But, you know, I think we can get surprised sometimes by the fact that people just want to create. And if they're drawn to a story or a project.
Yeah.
That's gold. It's not just about the bottom line dollars. I mean, it helps.
Yeah.
It's not just about that.
I also would add that, you know, whilst, you know, the lockdown has changed a lot of the way that we've done things, and people have suffered, we are living in precarious times, and people will lose their livelihoods. And, you know, there's a lot of frightening elements to this, and people have lost their lives. There are some things that are sort of definitely, you know, have changed for the better. Like many people, I've had a rest that I've really needed and a time to kind of breathe and find my feet. My flat has been cleared of so much clutter. I mean,
what
honestly,
was that like? What was that slowing down process like? Because as you say, you're kind of always on it, even when you're on a vacation, still there's stuff happening. So did you find that a little weird, or was it a bit of a shift mindset wise to reacclimatize to this quiet time?
Yeah, well, I mean, I got the virus, and
so,
you know, APOS pretty much a blur for me, although Fever Farah did order a lot of kind of compost, 350 litres. I have a one-bedroom apartment with a small balcony. It's a lot of compost.
That's
And as a result, I now have a vertical garden, which I built up when I got better, and I had a lot of blackboard paint, so there's a lot of blackboard walls that I'm drawing stuff and playing out stuff. But yeah, actually, it was a time for me to sit back and reassess. I got the Vision Award from the BFI during that time, and it's given me a chance to take a step back and look at the projects that I've got and what I need to do with them. And, you know, bearing in mind, for the past 5 years, I have been in non-stop production mode. I was in Malaysia for a year filming. I was in America for a half a year filming. You know, there's been a lot going on. And so for me, it's given me a chance to step back and breathe it. Even with, and just to finish about the After Rockcliffe showcase, we had 850 viewers from around the globe. People were watching, production people and sales agents and people and agents were watching it around the globe because they were able to watch it from their own homes. And we've never had as far reach as that. It's usually been about 200. And I know there were several companies in America that watch Showcase, and as a result of that, got in touch with us to be introduced to the writers. So that in itself is amazing, and we've had nothing but great responses. So I think until BAFTA reopens, this may well be the way forward for us. It will continue to do this in this way because the access is greater.
And even when it does reopen, whatever that looks like, which we obviously don't know, it's that awareness of the internet being this equalizer that in many ways it's the, you know, as you say, so many have been terrible that are going to be terrible. But on the flip side, you know, me talking to you now or me connecting with Faye or you getting agents and sales agents in the States to watch the show wouldn't happen necessarily in a world where we've all slowed down a little bit and had a bit of perspective come together.
There's been a huge amount of reach out to the writers as a result of this because we've had more time to read. And I, however, have been inundated with scripts from people asking me to read their work, from friends to strangers. I mean, to the point that I'm getting 10 scripts sent to me a week. Because of being sick, and, you know, there are underlying health conditions you come out of COVID-19 with, well, I have anyway, but you know, I've actually slowed down my working week. I'm only trying to work 3 days a week, which actually means I only work 5 days a week as opposed to 7 days a week. So psychologically, I tell myself it's very, in reality, it's about five. But each script takes me about sort of 3 hours to read and make proper notes on. And so if I'm only working sort of Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays, I have my own projects and my own slate of work to read. So getting 10 projects or 10 requests to read work, watch work, do introductions for people outside of the sort of the Rockcliffe winners at that time has been sort of, it's made me have to take a step back and go to people, look, I'm sorry, I can't read your work now. If I do, it'll take about 6 months to come back. But Rockcliffe does offer a feedback service. So, you know, I always feel bad asking people to pay to get feedback, but at the same time, my time is valuable and my time costs me money and it is the cost of business. And this is a business to me. It's not a hobby. So I'm finding my time is less and that I'm putting into my work day. But the time that I'm taking to kind of, you know, live my own life has become greater and I'm valuing my time.
It's that perspective, I think, that comes with all kinds of things. Obviously, you know, I I had to look after an ill parent last year as a carer. And then when they eventually passed away, your whole mindset shifts. And of course, but it's life. And I think like with what you're going through and have gone through, there is that perspective where you go, what's really important, really important. And how do I want to spend my time doing stuff that resonates with me that I'm passionate about?
Yeah, and I think it's also about measuring each other's expectations. So, for example, I would say to people, if you are reaching out to people, you know, like I said earlier, you know, contacting the Christopher Walkens and the, you know, the Jack O'Connells, you know, measure your expectations. Do not expect them to say yes, and if they do, it's a bonus. And I think that that's really important to be able to recognize within yourself and give people the space to choose and the space to say no. I mean, some people get very offended when you say no. I've had people who then keep being persistent in you know, their request for me to say yes. And I'm still going no. And it's very strange because I hate being rude to people and I hate being mean. But, you know, if you're going to ask somebody something, you have to be able to accept the fact that they may not be able to help you.
That's a life lesson with everything, isn't it? It's just, you know, want stuff but not need it to the point that you're going to compromise your own sort of identity and self-worth as well. Yeah. Like, so the point of like reaching out to people, and you mentioned obviously like Christopher Walken and people of that ilk, do you believe there's a certain time to which people should consider being ready to reach out to people, you know, because anyone can contact anyone, but do you believe in that first impression aspect a little bit being important and pick your moments, not just go spaghetti slinging?
I think it's actually, but it's a bigger question. So there are different sort of stages to that. I personally believe in only asking people through the proper channels. Mm-hmm. Because especially when I'm asking people that I know, they need to have a professional space in which to say no or to say yes, or to be able to ask the awkward questions. The reps ask the awkward questions about money, timing, you know, credits, all those sort of things. And that's just business. I think there's no harm in reaching out to somebody and asking them for a 15-minute coffee on Zoom and just getting a bit of advice from them. And I think that if you're asking people for advice, have your questions ready, prep yourself, be prepared, and don't just waffle on about yourself for 15 minutes or get somebody to explain who they are to you when you ask them for music. Know who they are, be specific in the questions that you ask them. When it comes to reading scripts, there is no harm if you feel a script is ready. There's no harm in getting some actors together and doing a Zoom table read of a script and hearing how it stands and asking them to give you feedback. It's a great way of hearing the words read aloud. You can see when they stumble in actors' words. So that's it. So it's a really useful thing to do. Setting up your own writers group where you can get feedback from other writers and colleagues, like your contemporaries, are your greatest allies. Try. If you're looking for validation, then don't send a script to somebody. If you're looking for proper feedback that you're going to use, then you send it to somebody. And be prepared to have to pay for that feedback.
And be willing to take on board that feedback and then also look at other people's feedback and create your own informed opinion as to what you want to do with that, which is all part of it. It's the expectations thing, I guess.
Yes, totally.
And I guess
that shouldn't hold you back, you know. And if you're gonna,
but it's validation, you know. That's a big thing that comes through. You know, I mean, I spoke to Faye about it. Many of the casting directors that I've spoken to, that's a big thing from an actor's perspective. You come into the industry looking for someone to fulfill you in some way, and this is not an industry that's going to validate anybody. It's actually, I know, but it's the antithesis of that. You almost have to know yourself so well to take all the rejection or whatever we want to label it and still strive forward to tell your stories and find your tribe. You know, it's such a subjective industry. I'm sure you've had millions of...
Yeah, but I also think that people too, there's another thing that people don't necessarily think about, which I think is quite important, that, you know, sorry, it's very hard to keep a train of thought when there's like a whole sing-along.
I'm enjoying this, though. It's new. It's new for me, too. I'm like, oh, how can we weave this in to a question? Yeah, I'm going to try.
You know, there's another aspect to it as well, which is that, you know, you shouldn't be afraid to reach out to people either. And I think that looking at the proper channels. So, for example, when you're sending a script to somebody and they agree to read it, then the script that you send them, don't follow it up 2 weeks later. Oh, by the way, I've got a new draft of the script. You know, if you haven't read it already, send your final draft. Be absolutely sure that there is nothing left in the script that you can change. And I think that's a very important thing to remember. And, you know, you will learn from your mistakes. We all make mistakes. That's absolutely fine. I mean, the reason why I wrote the two books that I wrote, one on screenwriting and screenwriting habits and how to approach people, is because some of it feels so foreign and actually it's all common sense. And then with the low budget filmmaking book, I wrote that one because I remember once asking somebody, could they show me a sample of a finance plan? And they made me feel so stupid for not knowing what it was. And, you know, I was being, you know, I was being a bit above myself putting together an application. And I just thought, wow. And then when I saw what one was, it's like a very small little sort of Excel box with, you know, how much money you're getting, what kind of money is it, what percentage of the budget is it. And that was it. And I thought, really? All that fuss over that? And so that's why I created those two books, just to give people access to commonplace information. It's not about the craft. It's just simply about common sense and the things that you can pick up this book and find out, which I felt was, you know, really important in describing the different kind of terms and funding bodies. I mean, everything is changing in many ways, but, you know, the fundamentals still remain the same.
I guess consolidating information in one place is always important for people because there's a lot of information out there now. As you say, things are changing, but with that comes this influx of noise from all over the place. And for someone starting out or fresh graduated, they might not know the woods from the trees as to where to go with it. And creatives in business don't always necessarily, well, creatives maybe don't always look at business as something they should consider. But it is obviously.
I'm not sure I agree with that, but I think the longer you work in it, the more sure. The business creatives describe themselves as creatives. I simply think that it is called show business after all, and I just think that some of these things, they're very easy to acquire and learn how to do once you see them written down in black and white. It's not rocket science. We're not saving people's lives.
The singing has stopped. I guess they weren't.
And making your money go further on screen are very simple things to learn that, you know, once you understand them, you can bring to the table.
Sorry, Farah, that kind of cut out there a little bit when you were talking. So I think you were mid a very epic, poignant piece and the whole thing stalled. And I was just ad-libbing about how, like, the people singing clearly had given up. So I won't make you repeat that point unless you think there was something super powerful there.
Well, yeah, I mean, all I was saying is that the value of money, what I've tried to do in the books is show people that, you know, what you can do and how you can stretch your money further. And that when you're writing things that may not occur to you, like having rain in a scene is really expensive. Having film, you know, at nighttime is really expensive. Having lots of locations is really expensive. If you're making a low budget film, try to limit the amount of locations and the amount of people. I mean, one of the best examples, I think, of a sort of chamber piece that I've seen lately, I mean, it's a few years old, there's Locke. And that's, you know, one, he's in a car the whole way through. And sometimes you have the kind of the poor man's process where you spray some water drops on the window and that's your rain in the window, and you just got lights going by.
Sure.
But it's like a powerful performance the whole way through.
Do you feel that moving forward, again, not knowing what's happening with the whole global situation, do you feel like those kinds of chamber pieces, you mentioned them, the one or two location contained pieces, is the most likely way to go with the next batch of projects, or is it hard to say?
I have my COVID-friendly film projects that, you know, involve sort of one actor, a key location, usually outside, you know, two-handers that I've literally specifically pulled together for this time. And then I have my projects that are outside of this. I think until there's a vaccine, it's going to be very hard to be able to secure the safety of actors on set. You know, when they're face-to-face, we've managed to cover everything else. But in terms of, you know, it's safety first. It's health and safety first at all times. And also insurance, being able to make sure that people are insured. And even on a low budget, like a short film, you still need insurance. You know, don't take people's lives. But don't put them at risk. Safety is no accident.
But no one's going to cover that. You're not going to get an insurer covering COVID.
Well, there's a lot of discussions going on at the moment.
Okay.
I think one of the plans is that there was a terrorism insurance pot in place since the 70s with the IRA, and they're looking at maybe extending that to cover COVID-19. So there are a lot of discussions in place. Nothing's been decided yet. Obviously, the government needs to intervene at this point, but I think the insurers want people to get back to work. I mean, that's what's important.
And I guess it's the same thing from actually a funding and financing perspective too. Isn't there that whole aspect of no one's going to underwrite a project or a film if you can't get the insurance through in the first place? So,
well, you can't close finance without insurance being in place. So, it's like a catch-22.
How do you see it? Do you think there'll be a bottleneck when things eventually ease up a little bit of lots of new stuff being made or projects held back?
Well, I think two of the things that I should say is that animation and documentaries are doing really well in this time. So those, you know, if you're in those areas, then literally start contacting all the companies, because that's one thing to remember. The third thing is that a lot of the TV shows that were shut down have the insurance in place, although I do imagine that that's going to expire soon. So they will be the first back up and running because they already have the teams and the preparation in place. And I know that there's some that are going ahead at the moment. It's just, so for shows that are filming, so I know in Northern Ireland there's some shows that Line of Duty is going back up. There's some children's shows that are going back up. But I think there's certain going to be licensing issues with children because you can't test children under the age of 5.
Right.
So I mean, there's certain things like that are going to have to be looked at and addressed. I know that some of the productions working in people's houses, you know, where they use those procedural dramas, use a lot of people's houses to film in. That's possibly not going to be possible because letting people in and you know, sterilizing them, cleaning them down. But I do think the shows that were already up and running will be the ones that get back up and running. They are going to have to do sort of extended schedules because we'll need to allow more time for each sort of department to go in and do their bit and clean in between each of those departments. I know that some commercials have been up and running, and all people are saying is that it's very hard in terms of the day to get everything done in the time that you need to get it done. So it is taking a lot longer to do what we need to do, which is new to everybody.
So. Yeah, that's what it feels like, isn't it? It's going to be longer times to actually just deal with, you know, what you normally would do in the space of half a day. You might need the full day to get that 30 seconds of footage or whatever it is. And it's just figuring out this whole new world. From an independent filmmaker's perspective, it feels like that could be a little bit perturbing because you might look at that and say, well, the big networks and studios have that backing, but how do I, as the indie person, get anywhere near being able to film something again that isn't just one person outdoors?
I can't speak for every independent producer, but I can tell you that as an independent producer, I don't want to be the first production back up and running because... I just don't know what it's going to be like. Yeah. I'd like to see some other people do it, and then we go and do it. I mean, the great thing about indie producers is that we have smaller teams. We're smaller packages. We're quite sort of mobile and agile because we have smaller crews. We don't have the big, huge, you know, bells and whistles that a lot of people have. That you know, when I was on the Singapore group in Malaysia, I mean, some days we had like 300 people and like 30 trucks. it's just like an enormous amount. Like it's like a circus, a giant circus on the move. Mm-hmm. And so, but with, you know, with a small indie film, you can have between, you know, 15 and 30 people. And that's a smaller sort of beast to move and shift around.
It's a fair shout. That's a fair shout. The mobility and the nimbleness of being an independent shoot maybe means that you can go into a venue and be less than 10 people and get what you need done, which is less scary for a location to maybe let you come in versus 300 people. For I'm going to kind of move it a little bit to sort of the fresh grads of the world a little bit if we can, just because these poor, I can't imagine what they're going through because they've just graduated wanting to come into the industry and their eyes are kind of lit up and then this happens. And like the rest of us, they don't know what's going on. But for them, it's like, I've just spent all this money on this course and I've just put all this time and I've done my final year film. And now what do I do? Like, what advice could you give to someone as a fresh grad just to use this time wisely and maybe be ready to come into the industry whenever it picks back up?
Okay. There is nothing stopping you picking up your phone and filming something and editing it yourself and just bringing that freshness and ingenuity to the table. I've seen films that have been done on iPhones. There's a couple of films that have come out. You guys are the fresh talent. Use it. Tap into it. Look at the things that really interested you that you did in college that you would have liked to have done when you were in college and didn't do. And what can you do with them now? I mean, it's a great time at the rest of us to read scripts, ask people for a 15-minute chat. You know, is there a way that you can, you know, I did a lot of work, in, you know, for people for free to kind of just see, and it's not ideal, but a week here and a week there and just saying, look, you know, it'd be great, can I read some scripts to you? And, you know, just try and make those connections because when things are going to be up and running, people are going to come to you and go, do you know what? I really like that kid. They came to me and they did this, that, and the other. Because I said, I'm getting loads of scripts every week coming in and I don't have the time to necessarily read them.
That's a really interesting point, though. It's something that, you know, any walk of business, if you're just graduating, to be willing to work for free, yes, it's not ideal, but to take it as an internship to learn is a different mindset as opposed to...
I mean, I don't believe that you should work for free on a production. I don't necessarily believe that you should work for free, but if you've got a week and you want to spend it with somebody, just shadowing them in that way. But if you want to shadow them, that's one thing. But I'm just saying, just say, look, what help do you need? You know, what can I do? Because those tend to be the first people that I think of when paid work comes up.
Well, it's because people are then coming actually adding value to you and offering you something, not just wanting to take something per se. Which feels like more of a, you know, fair exchange and everybody wins in that sense.
And I'm only saying that at this time. I'm not talking about if I had production going on, you know, it is a bit different.
Sure, absolutely. It's pick and choose your moments. But given right now everything's a little quiet, that's
I mean, I'd also say that Skillset, for example, are running some COVID friendly courses. People are sending me text messages and I can't switch off. So I'm like having to bat away the messages. I would also say that the Skillset are running training courses. They're running sort of COVID training courses. Be reading up on what's going on in the industry. Follow Screen International. Watch all the webinars that were in Cannes, for example. There's a lot going on there. Train yourself and just keep training yourself. There's a lot of free information out there. And, you know, BAFTA also run a lot of masterclasses and they've been doing a lot of webinars. So there's so much information out there to be inspired by. And read scripts. Use this time to really read scripts. I mean, every day is a school day for me. And every job that I do, I'm learning. And I don't think, you know, I only think I'm older. I don't necessarily think I'm wiser.
Maybe a bit of both. I'm sure there's wisdom that comes with the experience, Farah, but I think we're always learning and picking up new things. And yeah, this time has thrown us all into the learning curve, which is a good thing. So for you, when you were getting into this, what inspired you to get into the whole world of film? If we go way back to your backstory, what was the motivation to get into the film side of things?
Well, when I was sort of, so I come from a family of poets and artists and storytellers. And so my childhood was pretty much, you know, sitting around telling stories or about people, places, things. And my uncle and my dad were poets and writers. My mom was a young artist, and they would meet in pubs and, you know, do poetry reading. So I grew up in that circle of kind of sharing and talking about arts. And when I moved to England, I didn't really know that there was anything else other than acting and writing, and maybe directing, but I didn't know that there were other sides to the industry. Mm. And certainly from, you know, as a child, I would be at birthday parties and I would put on plays when the parents arrived. When I was little, the mum said they would go on for hours. So obviously I didn't know about editing then too. So when I went to drama school, I found it was a really good way of learning about character and character arts and development and emotional arts and emotional action. And I got to read things like Shakespeare and Chekhov and Ibsen, which I never would have possibly done in Restoration comedy. And so it was a massive education for me. So when I came out, I set up Rockcliffe as a way to kind of get actors, writers, directors together in a room. And then I thought, oh, it'd be really nice to make a short film because people were making short films. And I realized that producing is really where my talents lay. But as life progressed, you know, it was very hard to get jobs as a producer other than making shorts. So I ended up, and I wanted to learn from other people. I'm very curious and I'm very hungry about knowledge. So I started working as, you know, in production as a production coordinator, and then moved up to PM and line producer. And then I finally made a switch to producing in 2013, and I have never looked back. But it was hard. It was hard to make the switch and be taken seriously as a producer as well. But, you know, Rockcliffe has been this incredible force in my life, and it takes up a lot of my time. It is a passion project and a really great resource for me and for other people to find talent and new talent. I'm really excited by new talent. I think the greatest thing, lesson that I learned is that the only person that's really ever held me back has been myself. And it was about giving myself permission to learn and move forward. And that's been the biggest thing that I have learned over the last few years, that I can do this and I need to allow myself to do it. And I also need to allow myself to fail at the same time. And that's been something that the mistakes that I've made have been the greatest lessons.
And it goes back to what you said at the very top, which is, you know, just ask or just do, I suppose, to paraphrase that, in the sense that you can't make those mistakes without exposing yourself to all the eventualities of what could come from moving forward in the direction that you want to go in. It does sound like you kind of organically moved into this sort of world with Rockcliffe.
Oh, yeah. I wouldn't say I organically moved into it. I think I stumbled.
Right.
And fell on my head.
But still here to tell the tale, though, and there's something in that, right? Like, we should all be lucky to stumble and get a few bruises and bash your head
over. I mean, I'm really clear, you know, I know the kind of producer I am. I know my taste. I know that at the root of most of the projects that I work on, there's a survivor, there's somebody working out their identity. I'm drawn to writer directors, predominantly directors who are female or directors who can be categorized, you know, as being diverse. I myself am Libyan and Irish. I look like my Irish grandmother. My sister looks like our Libyan one. And, you know, I'm very conscious of how differently she's been treated because of the color of her skin, how I've been treated, and how differently, you know, how things are different for her. And so I'm, you know, those are things that I think about when I work.
You think about it because you've experienced it firsthand. And mm-hmm. I think that's the difference. You know, my dad was from Iran. You wouldn't think it. I look Mediterranean, or in this weather, pasty white. But I'm British, I'm Iranian, I grew up in Spain. I've never experienced that implicitly, bar the odd random check at an airport because of my surname. But I've seen my dad, when he was alive, go through a lot of things just because he was slightly olive-skinned. And that does have an impact on you when you go through it. And it's someone in your life directly that you know is experiencing this for labeled reasons, if nothing else.
Yeah, I mean, there have been quite specific things that have happened with me over the years. And this is not the time to have that discussion, but I will say that I think we all need to check ourselves and check our own behavior. I think we need to check the way that we look at things tonally.
You disappeared but came back.
Yeah, I'll just go back on that one for you and you can cut that bit. I think we all need to check ourselves and check our own behavior. I've been talking, there's a wonderful webinar called How to Talk About Race, Racism at Work, which is by Project 23. And I would urge everybody to have a look at that. I think going forward, I would encourage writers that I work with to remove any reference to race within the script where possible, because I think we should be casting in a very open way. If you look at my films, you'll see that I've done that, even in the TV work that I've done. And I think that that's really important, you know, and understanding that diversity doesn't necessarily refer to race. It can be age, it can be social and economic or regional, all sorts of different things. So, you know, understanding what it is and embracing it.
I mean, there's 7-8 billion people on the, you know, planet. It's impossible that it's impossible that we all think and have the same approach and the same cultures. And if we did, how boring would that be? We'd probably be extinct by now if that was the case. So absolutely. It's the embracing.
And there is only one race, the human race.
There you go. Exactly. It's interesting that you mentioned, obviously, that you have your own tastes. Obviously, it makes sense that you're drawn to particular themes and things. Did that happen over time, just organically? Again, there's that word. Or did you find that you had to really hone in on that more consciously? What made you really go, yeah, I can define that as my taste now?
Well, it's very broad how I describe it. But I also know that I'm very instinctive. And when I'm reading this script, sometimes I just look at the cover and I can feel that there's something about this script that I'm going to like. And then when I get into it, I'm usually right. And I can normally tell within the first 10, 15 pages whether a writer's voice is speaking to me. Now, just because they don't necessarily speak to me doesn't mean they don't speak to other people. Mm-hmm. But if the script speaks to me, and it has to speak to me within the first 10 pages.
And is that just, I mean, that's obviously a very, you can't really put words to that as to what that is. It's a feeling. It's a guttural kind of thing.
Yeah. And another thing I'd say as well is, no matter how good the script, if my meeting with the writer proves to me that we're not necessarily going to be compatible or the right pairing, then it doesn't matter how good the script is. It's unlikely that I will work on it. Because you have to spend 3 years with these people.
Yeah. You want to like the people you're working with, otherwise what's the point? And or at least vibe with them in the same creative mm-hmm. in the same creative way. When it comes to, I guess, you know, getting into those rooms then and people pitching and having those conversations, my view from the outside would be you want to come in, know your voice, and be authentic to who you are as a person, writer, director. But are there certain things that you would suggest to someone when it comes to pitching that they should really focus on and hone in on?
Yes, there is first of all, I think part of the pitch is yourself. And that can be hard for writers. Not every writer is confident in public or even in private. But part of the thing is just to have a discussion. Ask somebody for a 15-minute coffee. Work out what it is you both like and if you've got common ground. Don't be flattered when somebody says they want to work with you. You know, make sure that they're the right person to work with. The project comes later. If somebody comes to me with a project, you need to be able to sum it up in 25 words. You need to know what genre it is. You need to know who the audience is. If you don't know your project, how on earth am I supposed to know what it is either? Comparable titles, tonally, as opposed to budget. Because, you know, unless you are an experienced line producer, it's hard to know what a film is going to cost to make, unless you know specifically how much a dog costs per day and things like that, and how many days you can need your dog for. So
a lot, you know, those are more than some actors get paid sometimes, which is crazy.
Yes, they're very expensive. I recently worked with a monkey and a snake. They are very expensive.
Oh God! In the same shoot?
Yeah, this the Malaysian shoot.
Right. Okay.
So yeah, and there were lots of mosquitoes on that as well, but they weren't necessarily cast. It was just around us. The thing is, it's about connections and connectivity. So no matter how good a script is, you know, somebody's working out whether they know you or not. They want to work with you. So that's what's really important too. But those are things I'd say, know what it is. You know, you don't have to tell everybody the scene by scene or what actually happens in the whole script. You just need to know what it's about. And people are going to give you feedback and they are going to give you notes. And even if you don't agree with a certain note, but you agree that that area is working and you can identify that that area is working, it's up to you to come up with solutions.
But it's also, you know, you don't want smoke blown up your ass all the time. I think it's good to have someone who can give you the honest feedback and criticism and not take it personally.
Yeah. I mean, these are some of the topics that I cover in the book, because it's also about the writer-director relationship and you talking about, if you're both on the same page about the film that you're trying to make. And that's where it's really important that, you know, so them watching, there's a dog over there, just doesn't want to walk.
he heard that you cast animals before and maybe thinks there's some money in it for him.
And he's a pug, and it was the pug in the ABC Murders that was actually the biggest diva on set. Everybody else was fine.
Really?
It was actually the pug, yeah.
Well, like didn't want to come on and hit its mark?
Just didn't want to come on.
In the trailer. In the trailer all the time.
Yeah, the pug was quite amusing.
Amazing.
It is. I mean, I think it is all about connectivity, and it's all about, you know, making sure that the person that you're working with is the right person.
Absolutely. And I guess that's an ongoing thing. You know, people are in a rush to get somewhere and they don't really always know where they're going to. And I think it's building those connections over time that are, you know, you want to build friends in the industry that are friends first, and then, you know, you work with them as well because they're part of your tribe. Otherwise, life's too short. What are we doing?
Absolutely.
So this is a nice segue. I want to talk about Faye a little bit, because obviously she worked with you on the casting process for the showcase. How did that come to pass? How did you guys kind of end up working together and being involved in each other's lives?
Okay, so Faye, Laura Dickens used to cast for Rockford many years ago, and I think Faye approached her in a chipper and recognized her and asked her, could she come work with her? And then Laura was working at the time, and so Faye kind of just stepped into the role at the time, and she's great. She was absolutely great. I mean, Faye is ambitious for Rock. If she gets it, she gets what it is. We work together very well. She knows we're both committed to the same things. We know what the space is that we're trying to occupy, and you know, she's ahead of ahead of her at the curve. She's very, very talented. When she was working, she worked in an agency for a while.
Yeah.
And then I, you know, suggested some clients to her when she was working there. And then she went to work with Sophie in casting. And I just think she's, I love Sophie. I love Faye. I think she's hugely talented. Again, it's about connectivity. We get what this is and we get what we want it to be. And we're in sync on that.
Yeah, you can almost do it symbiotically without having to even speak sometimes, I'm sure, yeah. Because you're on the wavelength. How do you see it moving forward with the showcase? I mean, you mentioned at the top, it'd be quite a lot of online stuff for now. Do you think going into next year?
I think so. I mean, I would like to remain in the online format because I think it was really interesting and accessible. People can see the actors' faces and the emotions. There were some really powerful performances. When he cried that time was just so moving. Rockcliffe, I hope, will continue for many years and continue to have the success that it's had and be the thing that it is. Rockcliffe, the production company, has several productions in development. You know, we've made a sitcom, we've made a Netflix original. You know, we've got some award-winning short film content behind us. Long may that continue.
I saw there was the comedy piece that you had at the White House, and that is something I definitely had to pull on and be like, how does that happen? That must have been amazing. Did you get to go to the White House?
No, I didn't get to go to the White House. I did do the I was on the Women's March,
right?
I had to be in New York at the time, and I got up at 3 a.m. and caught a bus to Washington to be a part of that. Yes, that was part of the Obama administration's.
I was going to say, I imagined it being the past administration.
Yeah, it certainly wasn't. It wasn't the current administration.
Yeah, but that's amazing. That's like, how did that come to pass? Was that?
Well, Stephanie Lang, who she had an online platform called Pipo, which was a female-focused comedy platform. And she asked me to make some short form comedy content to like sketches to put in her platform. And we made that with Katie Llewellyn, who won the Welsh BAFTA recently and is a BAFTA breakthrough star. She's got an amazing series called In Our Skin on BBC Three,
yep,
which I recommend everybody to watch. And Katie wrote and starred in that particular sketch. It's great.
What a thing to be able to say that you actually had come to pass. That's amazing.
Yeah. So basically, Stephanie knew the administration had done some work for them, and they asked about some of the content that she produced and said that this particular sketch would be great for them to use. And so that's how it came back.
Incredible. Amazing. It wouldn't happen now. Well, no, it wouldn't happen now. All right. Well, look, I like to wrap these up, Farah, with the 10 questions that James Lipton would ask on Inside the Actor's Studio, if you remember.
Oh, yes.
You go. So
God bless him.
I know. Was he only passed away about 3-4 months ago, didn't he, James Lipton?
Yeah.
Sad. So I'm going to hit you with those, and let's just see, I guess, instinctively what comes to mind when I rattle them off. So the first question is, what is your favorite word? Was that
parapluie
it?
Parapluie comes into mind.
Okay.
It's a French word for umbrella.
Which we need quite often in these aisles, so it's probably not a bad word to have handy. What's your least favorite word?
Bottom.
What turns you on in a creative, intellectual, spiritual kind of way?
People.
And what turns you off?
People.
Yeah, I'm not even going to pull on that thread. That says everything all in one with those two answers. Fifth question is optional because some people don't want to always answer it, but it's what's your favorite swear word? And you can pass if you like.
Feck.
I'm glad you didn't pass. And that's the common answer, I think, a lot of people.
Well, like, I'm Irish, so I'm the only one who's attached to it.
There you go. Claim it. Next question is, what is your favorite sound or noise?
Waves. guys. I'm actually, or even just water. Actually, I'm just beside. I come down here. See, you can see the canal.
Yeah.
Over there. So that's why I'm down here, because I love the sound of water.
What is it?
Water, be it waves or.
So just peaceful and relaxing, or
yeah. Is it?
What's your least favorite sound or noise?
My neighbor's screeching at their dog to pee. Ooh,
that's a really specific one as well.
Yes, I have been living with it in lockdown. Pee, pee, pee.
Oh, God. Yes. Which yeah. I'm sure never works. The dog has no idea what they're talking about.
Oh, of course it doesn't. It's like 10 times a day as well.
What job or profession other than your own would you most like to attempt?
I've done so many.
Yeah, okay.
I think, do you know what? If I could do anything. Well, I know the ones I don't want to do.
That's the next question. Hold on. That's the next question.
I'll come back to that one.
Okay.
You know, I'm looking at a guy playing the cello at the moment, and I'd love to be a musician playing an instrument, but I don't play any instruments very well. I've learned, but I'm terrible.
I think I'm in the same boat. I would always say the same. If I was good enough, I'd love to play guitar, but didn't get the genes.
I just lost you there with the next question. There.
I didn't ask it, but the next question is, what would you not want to do as a job?
A lot of the jobs that I've already done.
Fair enough. I guess that's why you're not doing them anymore. Final question is, when it's all said and done, what would you like the story of your life to be? What kind of impact would you like to leave?
You know, I do think in many ways that Rockcliffe leaves behind a legacy of the writers that it's helped over the course of 20 years. And I would love to know that even if it isn't me, that Rockcliffe will have inspired somebody else to support the new voices, and that we keep helping new voices come up. And that new voices know that they're needed in order to keep things fresh.
Which is always a space. Huge part of what you're doing and have done, and I'm sure will continue to do, which is helping those new voices and new talent feel like there's a platform and setting the ladder down, I think, as they say, and you know, not pulling it up so people can't also have a chance to be heard and expressed. So, you know, kudos to you for doing that, setting it up, stumbling and falling into it, as you say you have, and then continuing to do it. Look, Farah, I guess final moments over to you, really. Anything that you want to plug or promote where people can find you online, and I guess any closing message that you think would be a good takeaway for people that tune in?
I mean, look, commit to a career, not a single script or idea. And allow yourself to evolve. You know, your tastes can change. They change as you get older. You're not the same person you were when you were 10, when you were 20, when you were 30, when you reflect back. And, you know, give yourself permission. Give yourself permission to fail. I do have two books. There's the screenwriting book, and then there's the low-budget filmmaking book. And I'd say to people, you know, rather than reach out to me, get those books, read them. They're not just my opinion. I interviewed 130 people to get their opinion on paper, including, you know, some of the most incredible filmmakers around.
Yeah, and if you pass me those links you spoke about at the top, I'll make sure I plug them there so people can go to them.
Thank
and they
you.
They can check out the site as well, which, because the site's also full of information too, so it's the books as well as everything that's on there. Awesome. Well, Farah, thank you so much for joining
thank
me and chatting with me. And it's been nice to
have a real honor.
Serenade in the background as well, which is...
Sorry, I mean, we could have done it at home, but the neighbors are all building.
I think this serenading is better than the drilling and building, so I appreciate it.